Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Think of this holiday season as a lull before the next political storm. A month from now, President George Bush will be sworn in and members of the 109th Congress will be taking their seats in the House and the Senate. They will set to work on some of the most controversial issues in years. What's at stake is nothing less than the way you pay your taxes, your plans for retirement, and the very ideology of this nation's courts. This will also be the Congress that weighs in on the direction and the funding of the war in Iraq. Even though Republicans have that rare upper hand in the White House and both chambers of Congress, it may not be easy for the president to have his way. This hour, a look ahead at the 109th Congress with two reporters who know the people and the issues well. We'd also like to hear from you. What are you watching? Is it going to be this fight over judicial nominations? Is it taxes? Social Security? Are you hoping that this session is less partisan than the last one, or do you actually want more opposition from the Democrats? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest this hour, Terrence Samuel, he is the chief congressional correspondent for U.S. News and World Report, and David Hawkings, he's managing editor of The Weekly at Congressional Quarterly, and they're both joining us from a studio in Washington. It's good to have you both here. Thanks for coming in.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for having us.
David, maybe I can start with you. In general terms, do you think it's fair to say that President Bush may, in fact, have more difficult time ahead, even though he's got a Republican-controlled House and Senate?
I think that's right. I think that he sort of has nowhere to go but down, in a sense. He's had an extraordinarily good run in his first term with Congress. The place I work, Congressional Quarterly, has been measuring how well a president does vis-a-vis Congress for 50 years. And George W. Bush, in his first term, got his way with Congress 82% of the time. Nobody's done that well since Lyndon Johnson. It's an extraordinarily high number. And it would seem to me that without the need to run for re-election again, and with a slightly enlarged and therefore a little bit more politically diverse Republican group in the Congress, he'll have a harder time. He'll have a very hard time sustaining that for another 4 years.
That same analysis that you're talking about, David, is also being pointed to as a measure of just how polarized the last Congress was. Does that mean that you're expecting to see a continuation of that, or maybe even more cooperation?
I think it's certainly getting off to a polarized start. If the sort of maneuvering in the last few days about Social Security is any indication. It does not seem as though we're moving toward an era of bipartisan good feeling up there.
All right. Terrence Samuel, that's one issue that we know of, Social Security. We've heard a lot about that from the president. If you were to throw a dart at the top two or three issues that you think are going to be key to watch once the 109th begins work, what would you say we should watch for?
Well, you know, the president has laid out his agenda, Social Security being clearly top of the list. Tort reform and tax reform.
Yeah.
However, I think, you know, the president has said that he has capital and he's going to spend it. Well, these are coupons and they don't, there's an expiration date on them. He does not have an unlimited amount of time to do this. And in fact, some people suspect that that time will be pretty short. He's going to have to deal with the deficit in the discussions about how you continue to fund the war, how you reform Social Security. We're talking about $2.2 trillion, what's being referred to as transition costs, but essentially it's money you have to go borrow mm-hmm. since the president refuses to raise taxes. And he is going to have to nominate more than likely at least one, maybe more Supreme Court justices. I would say the plate's going to be pretty full and the time to eat's going to be pretty short.
That's a great point. Yeah.
Go ahead, David.
I just want to say that the coupon analogy is a terrific one. Yes, they do have an expiration date, and each of the things that Terrence just mentioned are costly, very, very costly. He does have political capital. He's the first president to win with a majority of the popular vote since 1988. Since his father did in 1988. He actually got a majority of the popular vote. That gives him political capital, but the things Terrence just ticked off, each of them requires a large amount of political capital to get his way.
Now, some people who are very cynical about watching what happened during the last Congress are regard Congress as a sort of broken institution, giving away its war-making, war-planning powers to the president, captive always of the lobbyists. Would either of you buy into that, that Congress itself is a sort of a badly injured institution?
I would buy into it slightly. I think what you saw during the last Congress was a Republican Party in control doing almost anything to protect their president and their power at a time when the country was absolutely polarized. The issues almost did not matter. The top agenda item for the Republican Party was getting George Bush reelected. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to see some of that. With that off the table, I think you see the Republicans in Congress starting to reassert themselves. Harry Reid accused the Republicans in Congress of not wanting to be a separate branch of government. I think they return to that a little bit. That's why the president's going to have more trouble in his party than maybe from the Democrats.
Do you think, David, though, that it would that the difficulty that he'll have will be political? Other Republican congressmen, senators who are more interested in placing themselves as possible presidential candidates to replace George Bush? Or do you think that there's actually an ideological difference which separates this president from his own Republican Republican supporters, but Republican supporters in Congress?
No, I don't. And I don't think there's an ideological divide. I think the president is what we would call a mainstream conservative. He is also somebody whose own ideology he's proved to be somewhat malleable when he's been dealing with Congress in the last 4 years. One of the reasons that he's done so well with Congress is that he's picked his fights very carefully, and he's also shifted his position in some of these fights to get his way.
Right.
But in the main, the Republicans in Congress are a very conservative lot. They've become increasingly conservative after the last election. Several of the newcomers in the Senate, the new Republicans that have enlarged their majority in the Senate, are conservatives. So it's a conservative place. The moderates have a very dogged and determined but small lot. But in the main, he's got the voice that the ideological voice that he wants in Congress.
David, I think the president's problem is not going to be so much ideology, but the practicalities of governing. He does have to govern this country. He does intend to do all these things that he's laid out, and they cost money. And the Republican Party in Congress is a fiscally conservative party that's really uncomfortable with deficits, and that's going to show up in these fights that we see coming up.
They're also, this is my cynical line, they're uncomfortable with deficits. They are also uncomfortable with cutting spending. Members of Congress are preternaturally disposed to want to spend money, to want to send money home to their constituents, whether Republicans or Democrats, and they have had a very difficult time, the Republican rank and file in Congress, trimming the growth in spending the way the president's wanted. And that fight will definitely continue going forward.
Now, Terrence, I may be slightly misquoting the president here, but in his most recent news conference, he'd said something about the Social Security reform, said it would be written in Congress, that it wouldn't really be, his own idea sent to Congress. And I wasn't sure whether or not he was joking about that. I mean, he's the only one who really seems to be talking about this. Who's going to be driving the bus when it comes to Social Security reform?
I think that's called the fake olive branch. I think the president is very cognizant of how difficult it is to do big things. And I think what you were hearing there is an effort to respect the authority of Congress, to play into that that concern that some people have that Congress is giving away all its authority. Actually, all the president has said that he wants in Social Security is that it be reformed and that it include this option of privatized accounts for individuals who want them. Apart from that, he says that this is a bill that should be written. This is legislation that should be written in Congress.
Although, David, he ran an entire election campaign beating on the podium about exactly what he wants Social Security to become. There aren't a lot of secrets left there, are there?
Well, there's you know, the biggest cliche in politics and in legislating is that the devil's in the details. And yes, I think there's thousands of these details to be negotiated. When he pounded on the podium, I think he didn't say much more specifically than what Terrence just said.
Hmm.
He wants it made more financially stable so that there's not this crisis in 3 decades when the bulk of baby boomers become retirees.
Right.
And he wants to allow people to invest some of their what are now payroll deduction taxes in accounts that they can manage. But that is... that is a super superficial thing, and there are tens of thousands of decisions to be made underneath that.
Right.
And I think this is what we're seeing here. I don't view it as a fake olive branch so much as more of the same from the president in his dealings with Congress, which is he throws out a generalized principle and then says, "You all in Congress figure out the details, and I'll be happy with what you give me." This was the same, more or less the same. With the tax, his two big victories in his first term, most of his big victories in his first term, the big tax cuts, mm-hmm. he left the details to Congress. No Child Left Behind, many of the details left to Congress. Creation of the Homeland Security Department, many of the details left to Congress. The Intel reform bill that we just saw him sign last week, most of the details left to Congress.
Okay, good observation there. 1-800-423-8255. What are the issues that you're going to be watching when the 109th Congress convenes next year? We're going to go to Raleigh, North Carolina for our first call. Wendell's joining us. Hi, Wendell.
Hi, how are you doing this morning?
Fine, thanks. What do you think?
Well, personally, I think that just because the GOP is in charge, and if we stand up for ideals, I sincerely hope that the Republicans in the Congress and the Senate will work with the president and with the Democrats. But when we stand up for our ideals and the Democrats want to accuse us of being partisan, that we'll stick more to our ideals and not succumb to the threats of the liberal left.
When you say we, you're talking about the Republican Party? You're talking about conservatives? Who's the we you're referring to, Wendell?
Well, when I refer to the Republican Party, we, the conservative Republicans,
right.
But conservative America, you know, we need the American values that were guaranteed us in the Constitution reinstituted back in our government. And I don't think that, you know, letting Ted Kennedy write education bills is the way to go about it. And I think that, you know, because George W. Bush was given a mandate by the people that he should be allowed to exercise his agenda with the authority that he was given by the electorate.
But what you're saying about the Ted Kennedy side is that you don't want those people inside the tent. You want them acting as an official opposition, right?
That's not what I said. It's not a matter of, you know, we don't mind working with. When I say we, I'm saying I would not mind seeing the GOP work with Ted Kennedy. But when Ted Kennedy takes and writes an education bill that circumvents the conservative values that we share as a nation, then no, we've become acquiescent to the positions that have put us in power. And I really sincerely hope that having, you know, been put in power, that we will act on the mandate that we were given.
Wendell, we're going to take a short break. We will come back with my two guests, David Hawkins and Terrence Samuel. We'll talk more about exactly what the thrust of the 109th Congress is going to be. Do you agree with Wendell that it is important for those who are elected to take the principles that they ran on and make sure that those are the principles behind the legislation that's written? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. Judicial nominations, taxes, Social Security, big issues facing the 109th Congress. With us on the program this hour, David Hawkins, managing editor of The Weekly at Congressional Quarterly, and Terrence Samuel, chief congressional correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Just before we go back to the guests, a chance to hear from another caller. Concord, Massachusetts. Brian's with us. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Tell me what you're looking forward to.
Well, I'm hoping that the Democrats are finally going to rise up and open their mouths. I've just been watching them keep their mouths shut or say things that are completely ridiculous instead of actually addressing the problems for a number of years now. I was listening to the last caller, and I was hearing him speak about we as a conservative nation, and I'm not sure exactly where he comes up with we. George Bush only won the popular vote by 3 million-some-odd votes. Yes, in size, in number, that's a large number, but when you compare it to the size of the nation, it's actually not that large. The nation itself, only half of the nation voted for him.
Are you saying, Brian, that in the last Congress, the Democrats sort of rolled over and let the Republicans have their way, and you don't want to see that again?
If they had rolled over anymore, we would have rolled them directly into the grave. I think they've given away way too much. And I think until they start opening up their mouths and fighting for what they stand for, you know, they let the Republican Party turn the word liberal into some shaming term. And what I always understood liberal to mean was that we were going to have to include people in what we do, that you weren't going to be able to exclude, and that liberals were actually strong. You stood up for your values. You opened your mouth in places where other people weren't going to open it.
All right, Brian, let me just stop you there and ask David and Terrence to look ahead on this this next Congress and whether or not we should expect to see, in fact, more opposition. I mean, let me start it this way. Are the Democrats themselves feeling like they dropped the ball last time around?
I don't think so. I think actually the Democrats, I'll stick up for the Democrats here and say that I think that they played a very savvy defensive game in the last Congress. Senator Tom Daschle, the minority leader, who ended up losing in part as a result of this, the Senate is the bulwark for the Democrats against the Bush agenda, just to give a 10-second civics lesson. The Republicans have a majority in the House. They had this absolute power in the House. Mm-hmm. In the Senate, however, it takes 60 votes to do almost anything in the United States Senate. And the Republicans had 52 of them last time. They have 55 this time, Senate seats. And so the Democrats still have extraordinary power to play defense. And they used it pretty extensively in the last 2 years, blocked many of the things President Bush did want, this entire so-called tort reform agenda, limiting the reach of the trial lawyers and limiting damages in lawsuits, several other bills that the Democrats were able to prevent from going through, and Harry Reid, the new minority leader, has served notice that he's going to be operating very much the same way.
Terrence, just hold your fire for half a sec. I want to hear from Brian again in Concord. Brian, David is saying here is that the Democrats did stand up as best they could last time around.
But you know what? We've been playing defense since Newt and Bob Dole. We've been playing defense. When are we going to go on the offense? You know, I've had enough with the defense. And, you know, to use an old cliche, the best defense is a really good offense.
All right, Terrence, let's hear from you on whether or not the Democrats have the wherewithal in the 109th to do what Brian's suggesting.
You know, I think, to echo David's point, that part of the reason that President Bush and the White House took Senator Daschle so seriously is because they understood exactly what he was doing to their agenda. In some, particularly on judges, on tort reform, in a lot of ways, he stopped them cold, and it was deeply frustrating to them. And I think the Republicans are going to be reminded once again that to be in power is not to be in control. Harry Reid, who, you know, everybody went after Daschle as the obstructionist. Well, Harry Reid was the field general on most of that. He was the man on the floor doing this, and he is, he's a soft-spoken guy, but he's much more direct and much more blunt. This guy used to run the Nevada Gaming Commission once upon a time. And he intends to play this game, I think, a lot more openly. And then, you know, he said that Clarence Thomas was not fit to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. This is going to be, I think, more contentious. And I think the Democrats have decided pretty much what your caller is saying, that it's time to fight.
And David, I mean, just exactly how far could this go? If we stick with the issue of judicial nominations, we've heard the Democrats threaten to use filibusters on those nominees that they don't like. We've heard Bill Frist warning that if that happens, the Republicans will go so far as to change the rules of the Senate, do away with the filibuster, and I'm not sure at this point if that's just bold talk in advance of the beginning of the session, or whether or not you're seeing that there actually could be some kind of significant confrontation over this.
No, it's not bold talk. I think that they are very seriously contemplating this. I think that one of the things that one of the reasons they haven't unveiled it quite yet or gone down this road is there may be some people, some Republican senators in Bill Frist's own caucus who might not want to do this. This would be a dramatic changing of the culture of the Senate. Talk about polarization and gridlock. This would almost assure a 2 years, probably several more years than 2 years, of deep-seated, intense anger on the part of the Democrats if the Republicans were to change the rules, do away with the filibuster. I mean, this is sort of goes to the core of what makes the Senate, what makes Congress, Congress. It would be, hard to underestimate how intense the feelings are on this on both sides.
And just in simple mathematical terms, do they have the muscle to do that if the Republicans actually, you know, get every member of the Senate to agree that, yes, in fact, the Democrats need to be taught a lesson and will put an end to the use of a filibuster on a judicial nominee? Can they do that?
Well, there are 55 Republican senators starting on January 3rd. So the question is, can Bill Frist marshal at least 50 of them, plus the Vice President of the United States, Dick Cheney, to get what he wants? I think that's a deeply open question because there are several senators that I can think of off the top of my head who have been around long enough to remember what it was like when they were in the minority mm-hmm. party, and this was their power. This was what, I mean, you know, turnabout is fair play. And if they're going to unsheath this sword, to come up with a tortured metaphor, someday it's going to be used to stab them. And I think that those with long memories, the veteran Republicans in the Senate, are going to be very leery of this. Right.
And they understand that this could happen in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years. And in the life of the U.S. Congress, that is not a very long time.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking about the session of Congress, which is to begin early next year. Lots of crucial legislation is to be talked about then, tort reform, tax reform, Social Security reform. We're also talking about judicial nominations and whether or not you think that the balance of power, the exercise of power, will change in that Congress. We're going to go to our next call in Boston. Harley's joining us. Hi, Harley.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. What do you think?
A set of issues that didn't come up during the campaign are environmental issues because they were, I think, seen largely as locked in by Senator Kerry and the Democrats. But I think they're going to come up because there are some imperatives that have to be addressed.
Are you thinking of any in particular, drilling in Alaska?
Yeah,
what do you think?
Just quickly, a couple of quick examples. One would be air emissions that relate to global warming. I think that issue is likely to come up because the Bush administration has been pretty weak with their Clear Skies initiative. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the oil drilling both in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge and other areas. I think that is going to come up. The Republicans will probably bring that one up. And then I would say another example would be natural resource extraction, both forest and other natural resources from federal lands.
Terrence, these are pretty important issues for many Democrats. I wonder how close to the top of the docket they are, though, in anticipation of this Congress. Are they going to, you know, are they going to be able to even put issues that matter to them, you know, before the Republicans, or are they basically going to have to follow the lead as to the legislative lead set by the GOP?
I think they've decided on a couple of things. I think they've decided that the Democratic agenda is not necessarily going to be a congressional agenda. I think they've decided that they have to take it to the country. The environmental issues mentioned, I think, have moved way up the list for one reason. Colorado. Colorado was maybe one of the real bright spots for Democrats this last time around. They managed to pick up a Senate seat, a House seat held by Republicans. They retook control of the legislature, and it was largely in part of environmental issues that they argued up and down that ticket and throughout that election, throughout that state. And I think a lot of Democrats are looking to Colorado as a model of how they proceed in talking to people in, quote, red states.
That on environmental issues, they can, in fact, break apart the sort of partisan splits and speak to the people beyond their party affiliations?
there is, kind of a residual authority that they have on environmental issues, and people actually do care about it. And when they talk about it, there is a sincerity and a genuineness that I think that the rest of the message has been lacking lately.
All right, David, what about Anwar, though? My recollection from the election campaign is that the Republicans actually plan to put this before Congress again, and they expect to win it this time around.
Yes, that's right. The president has had an energy policy package that he's been trying to push unsuccessfully through Congress for the last 3 years. It'll be back in a retooled form one more time. Drilling in Anwar, Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, is definitely the hottest of the hot-button issues in that entire package, and yes, they'll try again. Once again, this will get overwhelming, or solid, I shouldn't say overwhelming, a solid majority, at least in the House, mm-hmm. Republican House, but in the Senate, it's that filibuster thing again. And in this case, my prediction would be that the Democrats will once again block it.
1-800-423-8255. A look ahead at the 109th Congress and your thoughts on either what is important or what should be important when the politicians go back to work after the holidays. Next to Grinnell, Iowa, and Pablo's joining us. Hi, Pablo.
Hi.
What do you think?
I had a question about Social Security. One of your guests mentioned that Social Security was likely to be in crisis in 2 or 3 decades. But I heard in the last study that was released, commission study a few years ago, that it was viable till 2050. It seems to me the Republicans are sort of pushing this idea that Social Security is in a near-term crisis mm-hmm. in order to force sudden changes on us. I want to know, is that true?
I'm glad you asked the question because I know that is a part of the debate. And David, Terrence, I'm not sure which one of you wants to pick this up with Pablo.
I believe that 2038 is the
date.
Is the year in which income exceeds, in which payments out exceed revenue coming in. So they have until 2038, and then once that Rubicon is crossed, it's very fast into complete insolvency.
So there's
a huge ramp up in people claiming this money.
All right, so 2038 isn't a difference of just a few dollars and a few more the year after that and the year after that. It gets pretty dramatically out of balance pretty quickly,
right.
Is what you're saying?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's what I believe is the case, yes.
Pablo, back to you. Just tell me what your thoughts are in looking ahead here.
Well, even there, 2038, that's 34 years from now. It seems to me you don't make dramatic changes in social policy in crisis mode mm-hmm. when the crisis is 34 years away.
It's interesting, though, Pablo, that you would have, a president who is saying, okay, even if it is 30 years away, if we don't start dealing with it now, it's going to be that much harder to deal with when it's 20 years away or 10 years away. Are you willing to grant him that, Pablo?
No, I don't think so. I think this is part of sort of the procedure of this administration to create a crisis and a need for action where right. really none exists. Like, we needed to go into Iraq. They pretended that there was an emergency there. They pretended that there were weapons of mass destruction. There weren't any. Now they're saying that Social Security is in a near-term crisis. Your guest just said it goes into the red in 2038. My understanding is the trust fund that's been building up till then can be drawn on at that point, and that's supposed to last until 2052. It's not a crisis.
Okay, Pablo, let's hear from David and Terrence just on how the Democrats are marshaling their own opposition to Social Security reform. Is it the same? Is it, as Pablo's saying, a warning not to automatically switch into crisis mode here?
I think you're going to hear Pablo's arguments incorporated in what the Democrats have to say about this. What they're saying is that the administration is creating a crisis in Social Security in an effort to look like it's active, when in fact the real crisis is in Medicare, and he is unwilling to address that. I think that is essentially the thrust of the Democratic counterargument as it unfolds over the next few months.
But so where does it go? Does that mean that, in effect, all the Democrats really have to do is spin this out to 2006, get it tangled up in the next set of congressional elections, and maybe not have to deal with it at all while President Bush is in office?
I think what what we're having here is essentially an argument about what to do down the road. As urgent as the president makes it sound, I think the Congress is going to be much more deliberate, and I don't think it's just going to be Democrats. I think a lot of people are going to say, let's do this a lot more carefully. And part of his part of the president's problem on this is going to go back to how he sold Iraq.
We heard that from Pablo, this sort of suspicion out there.
He's not going to have, I think, nearly as much credibility on saying, do this because I say it's a crisis as he did on Iraq.
It's a fascinating point Pablo made, which I think is right. His reservoir of trust is down, and it's a paradox actually that here he is having just been reelected as we've said with a popular vote mandate, yeah. And yet the polling subsequent to the election, his approval rating has gone down. It's inched steadily downward since the election. The most recent poll that I saw, which is here in Washington, the Washington Post had a poll yesterday showing that a solid majority think the war was sort of sold on false pretenses and has gone the wrong way. And his so there's this sort of paradox where here he is popularly reelected, but with a sort of more of a reservoir of distrust than most presidents are in this situation.
So when we look at something like Social Security reform, David, are you anticipating that he'll get as much opposition from within his own party as from Democrats?
I think it will be opposition I think I'm echoing what Terrence said, which is that it will be not so much frontal opposition as just a disinterest and a decision to not tackle something that will require it's a hugely complex and will require an enormous bipartisan expenditure of political will and political capital. And so I don't see this as much of a starter on the agenda myself. I don't think it's going far.
Connection listeners, tell me what you're looking for in the 109th Congress. Do you think that the Senate and the House will, in fact, reach some kind of partisan deadlock over judicial nominations? Is that what you think will mark this next Congress? Do you think that decisions to fund the war in Iraq will become more controversial than they were last time around? What are you looking for? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Listening to The Connection, my name is Dick Gordon. We're interested in knowing if you think this next session of Congress is going to be perhaps less partisan, less contentious than the last one, or are you looking for more opposition from the Democrats? A cast ahead at the 109th Congress with David Hawkins, managing editor of The Weekly at Congressional Quarterly, and Terrence Samuel, chief congressional correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Terrence, I just want to start off this part of the program with a step away from legislation, because while that's what Congress is supposed to be all about, we know that it is frequently a place where we watch and listen to stories about characters. And Tom DeLay, for example, is someone who is continually in the news, knocked about by the Ethics Committee, but still supported by his Republican colleagues. Is he going to remain a key figure in the House in this next session?
That's an absolute yes. Tom DeLay has made himself absolutely crucial to the success of the Republicans. He knows how to move legislation. He knows how to get things passed when it's at all possible. And he is absolutely dogged in the way he's done it. And so even Republicans who are unhappy with the way he operates cannot argue with his success. And that's why you saw the Republicans do something that's been absolutely stunning to a lot of people, even in Washington, in that they've changed the rules in anticipation or in fear that if Tom DeLay is indicted for campaign finance violations in Texas, that he'll be able to remain as majority leader. It's a rule put in place before they were in power, mm-hmm. and they changed it in power, and it's absolutely incredible. But Tom DeLay is front and center.
Is he, David, destined for the Speaker's chair? Is he going up before he goes down then?
Well, that's an excellent question, and one of the great parlor games for those of us who pay attention to Congress. I think timing is everything. The incumbent speaker, Dennis Hastert, is widely expected to be reelected without opposition next month. However, there is sort of lots of water cooler talk at the Capitol that he's starting to get tired of the speakership, and that he might want to move on. He might be open to being an ambassador. Ambassadorship to Japan has been talked about. Were the speaker's chair to be vacant, that would be the fascinating thing as to whether Tom DeLay, despite his ethical troubles, mm-hmm. Could be elevated to the speakership, and whether ultimately it would be the right place for him in terms of playing to his strengths. I mean, if you were sort of a manager and if Congress was your company and you were trying to sort of position your senior managers in the positions that suited them best, being the Speaker of the House might not actually be the best place for Tom DeLay. Where he is right now and where he was before as the whip are sort of arguably better jobs, because the speakership is a national office. It is the place where the institution, where people are supposed to be institutionalists, have a respect for the institution, have a sense of bipartisan gravitas.
Well, it's line of succession too, isn't it?
It's also in the presidential line of succession. And there is some thought, even among the Republicans, and Terrence is absolutely right, that Republicans who don't agree with him ideologically, Republicans who are troubled by his ethical troubles, they can't argue with the success, and they cannot argue with the fact that he has made their lives, their political lives, and their legislative lives much easier through his own doggedness and his own perseverance and his own insistence on getting his way.
One more name that I wonder that if I could just hear from you both on briefly. When we talk about characters in the Senate, we talk about John McCain and Chuck Hagel and Joe Biden and Harry Reid, but John Kerry re-enters the Senate in a slightly different light this time around. How are we to regard him? Where will he stand among his own colleagues and in opposition to Republicans?
Talk about parlor games. But I think John Kerry, I think John Kerry has made it clear that he intends to run again for president. And that puts him in a very interesting place. You know, we're talking about Anwar. John Kerry was the guy who basically said, it's not going to happen on my watch the last time around. Mm-hmm. Absolute willingness to filibuster it. And I suspect you'll see more of that. You know, he's trying around town to act like the head of the party. He's giving advice on what kind of candidates should run, how the party should be broader. But I think a lot of people are, you know, now looking at this guy as one of another long list of people who are going to be lining up for president in 2008.
Very long list. I mean, there's always one of the old saws in Washington is that the Senate is a place where all 100 senators look at themselves in the mirror in the morning and see the next president. That cliche seems more true than ever going into 2008.
I guess what
McCain,
I'm wondering, David, is
John Kerry.
Yeah. What does Kerry bring with him back to the Senate that either does or doesn't change his stature? Because if he does, in fact, fancy himself as a presidential candidate next time around, he's got to keep a profile that's higher than Hillary Clinton and a number of other people who have their eye on that.
Right. I don't think he brings much back with him to the Senate. I mean, I think, you know, other than to be a little bit coarse about it, he brings back with him the baggage, the mantle of being a loser, of having sort of many Democrats, I think he squandered it. So I am not sure that he brings anything all that positive with him. He does not. I mean, some of the polling suggested that his support was wide, but not all that deep,
right.
Not a passionate reservoir of deeply committed supporters. He's certainly a national figure. He has international stature and international name ID as having been the Democratic nominee. But I don't feel like he's head and shoulders above the other big Democratic figure in the Senate, Hillary Clinton.
He's got a couple of things going for him. Clearly, he is now known in every corner of the earth. So when he speaks, more than just the Massachusetts press corps is going to show up. However, and in addition to that, you know, he got more votes in an election than any Democrat ever, and on and on and on. I think Kerry's big advantage is what's happening here. We're talking about him, and that's going to continue to happen. You know, I've seen press references to Capitol Hill leaders Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, and John Kerry. So if that happens, even though he's not part of the elected leadership, I think his aim is to keep that going.
It's been half a century since we had a Democratic nominee who got two shots, and I don't. History is against him, but
1-800-423-8255. The people and the politics of the 109th Congress. What you're looking for? What's going to be different? What's going to be the same? We're going to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, for our next call. Eric's on the line. Hi, Eric.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. What do you think?
I'm concerned about the astronomical deficit that this president and some before him have racked up, and I'm worried about what choices this Congress is going to have to make and what choices President Bush will want the Congress to make in order to keep funding the war in Iraq.
I wonder, Eric, if you don't mind me asking, do you raise a question about the deficit from a partisan perspective as a Democrat angry with a Republican administration or as a taxpayer without regard to party?
You know, if the bill's in and it's going to need to get paid, and I don't really mind whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. It's sort of like when the phone bill comes to my house, sometimes my dad pays it, sometimes my mom pays it, whatever works.
But somebody has to pay it.
Somebody's got to pay it or you don't get a phone.
Which one's the Republican?
And David and Terrence, when you add that to ideas about Social Security reform and tort reform and the other things that are going to cost money and a president who is absolutely determined to have his lips read that no new taxes will be put in place, mm-hmm. How do they resolve that?
Oh, they're going to keep running a deep deficit and just assume that it does not become – I mean, it ultimately was not much of a political issue in this last campaign. There is a school of thought that in wartime, especially, deficits are politically tolerable and economically tolerable as well. Mm-hmm. But it's getting to be a lot of money. They've spent this is sort of good back – something to have in the back of your mind – so far, the military campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan have cost us $203 billion. In the next month, the president is going to send up a request for another piece of it, we think between $60 and $80 billion more, and that's just to get us through 2005.
Can I just before we go on, is that a slam dunk for him? Does he just have to stand up there and say, got to armor those Humvees, remember the soldier who talked to Rumsfeld, and bang, he'll have the vote?
Yes, absolutely. However, I think that there is growing unease with the size of the deficit on the president's side of the aisle. And I think as the war becomes increasingly unpopular, David mentioned the poll yesterday. I imagine that those numbers are not much better today after the news from Mosul. Mm-hmm. I think the president's going to have a harder time justifying the war and then justifying paying for it. And, you know, the Democrats are in their search for a way to talk about these things have decided that they're going to refer to the deficit as the baby tax. You know, the president keeps talking about not wanting to raise taxes. Well, their point is that he's raising taxes on your kids because kids born today are the ones who are going to have to pay it. It's going to be, I think it's going to move from a marginal issue to the forefront just not that quickly.
Let's take another call from Phoenix, Arizona. This one is Tony. Hi, Tony.
How you doing? You know, what I was going to say was I think what's going to happen is what typically happens when the Republicans just seem to be on the cusp of having a certain amount of power and seeming like they're going to be able to consolidate that power, they're going to end up trying to overreach their mandate. And I've heard some pretty radical guys in the Senate, Santorum and some of the newer Republican senators that are coming into power. And I wouldn't be surprised if a couple of Jim Jeffers moves get made by a few of the more moderate Republicans who I think are going to be marginalized. You know, maybe some of those Northeasterners, like
what
Lincoln
Champion,
some of the other ones.
Yeah, how about Senator McCain?
I don't know about Senator McCain. I don't really know where he stands right now. I think personally he's still thinking about the presidency, but I really don't know. I mean, yeah, he's a moderate, but he showed in this election that he's a party guy. I mean, mm-hmm. I know he hates Bush's guts, but yet he went around stumping for him for this election, but. I believe that the Republicans are going to have a real hard sell. They're going to be very, very hard to rein in for the president. and they're going to challenge him a lot more. I think this is going to be a very tough 4 years for President Bush.
Now, Tony, it's a great question. I'd like to hear from both guests on you know, what happens to those Republicans who consider themselves moderates? Are they going to find themselves increasingly uncomfortable with the legislative direction of this Congress?
Well, I think that kind of all bets are off. You know, like I said, the president is not up for re-election, and people are in a position to challenge as they see necessary. I think what's going to be interesting is the part of the party that feels most responsible for the president's victory, the Christian evangelicals, and how much of a price they're willing to exact for their support. And I think, as the caller mentioned, there are some new voices in the Senate particularly who are going to make it very interesting for the Republicans to sound like moderate or compassionate conservatives. You know, Senator Coburn from Oklahoma is going to be interesting. You know, he wants to keep delivering babies. He thinks that there is an outbreak of lesbianism in Oklahoma. I think these are going to be very interesting voices for the Republicans to rein in or control or manage. And does it amount to overreaching? Not yet, but it'll be interesting.
David, what do you think about some of the moderates? Do you think that they'll have difficulty with the direction of the party?
I think that they will, and I think that they will largely be able to exercise their voice without much effect, because now, I mean, one of the advantages to President Bush, I mean, this is where the president's and the Republican Party's gains in Congress really do help the Republicans, because now they can afford essentially to ignore moderates that they had to pay attention to in the past several years, especially in the Senate, where there are some times where they need 50 or 51 votes just to move things along. And some of the moderates were able to extract a pretty high price in order to go along. Now with 55 votes, they can afford to lose a Susan Collins or an Olympia Snow or a Jim Jeffords or an Arlen Specter even.
But does that mean then that there is less reaching across the aisle and
I think that's right. I think
henceforth more partisan noise coming from this Congress?
I think that the moderates, especially in the Republican moderates in the Senate, are a little bit marginalized by this. And so their voice can be brushed aside and partisanship can reign supreme.
All right. I want to thank both of you. David, thanks very much for being with us on the program.
I enjoyed it a lot.
David Hawkins is managing editor of The Weekly at Congressional Quarterly. And Terrence Samuel, appreciate your time as well.
Thanks for having us.
Terrence is chief congressional correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugart. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.